Good morning, I'm Sam Zeff, in for Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. I want to start the show this morning with a clip of a KU-Kentucky basketball game.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to CBS Sports coverage of the NCAA National Championship. Today's game is between the Kentucky Wildcats and the Kansas Jayhawks.
And while that sounds like a real CBS broadcast, it's really an EA video game for PlayStation 3 from several years ago. Those are real Jayhawks on the screen, if you've got it, Cole Aldridge, Tyshawn Taylor, Marcus Morris. But they realize little, if any, money for the use of their names and images. College sports is a multi-billion dollar industry, but the men and women who play the sports we love to watch, well, they don't get a cut of that huge pie. But a recent decision by the NCAA might change all of that. With me on Central Standard this morning to talk about all of this is Patrick Ruby, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who's been covering athletes' rights in college sports for more than a decade. He joins us from Washington. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we have two local former college athletes. Michael Watson is a former UMKC basketball player who just had his number retired. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Carrie Fry Robinson is here. She played soccer at Indiana University, and a pleasure to have you on Central Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick, I want to start with you. There hasn't been a college sports video game released in several years, and that has to do with a lawsuit filed by a former UCLA basketball player. And I think it's a good jumping off point because that was really the first crack in getting college athletes some compensation for their images. Can you talk about that lawsuit?
Sure. So that lawsuit came from Ed O'Bannon, who was a basketball star at UCLA in the 1990s. Many years later, you know, towards the end of the 2000s, he noticed that an EA Sports college basketball video game basically had him in it. You know, it had classic college basketball teams. His UCLA team, which won the national championship, was there. It did not have his name, but it had his avatar, his number, his shaved head. The player was the same, I think, left-handed as Ed was, had the same kind of stats. For all intents and purposes, it was a digital avatar of Ed O'Bannon. And he realized, you know, they're using this and they didn't harass me and they're not paying me. And how is this legal? How is this possible? And that's what started this sort of what was, you know, O'Bannon versus the NCAA, which was a federal antitrust lawsuit that it took about 5 years. It started with video games. It ended up also bringing in TV broadcast rights and a bunch of other things. And essentially it was the first time that the NCAA was successfully challenged in federal antitrust court over its amateurism rules and restrictions on college athletes, which basically tell college athletes, you are limited in what you can receive, you know, for playing sports and for your name and for your fame from playing sports to a scholarship, an athletic scholarship, and now also a small cost of living stipend in some cases, which has been sort of the rule forever in college sports.
Patrick, and there was a settlement in that case, but the players got a puny amount of money, did they not?
They did. So what happened is while the federal judge found that the NCAA was violating antitrust laws, and it's a pretty open and shut case in terms of if you think of any other business in America, all the competitors in a business field, they can't get together and say, we're going to only pay people a certain X amount of dollars, and no one can get more than that. That's on its face completely illegal. But the colleges have been able to sort of get away with that forever. The judge said you're violating antitrust law, but did not actually impose a remedy of you need to stop doing that, which is kind of where we are right now in the federal legal system. The judges have found over and over that the NCAA and its schools shouldn't be doing this, but they're reluctant to sort of press the red button and actually change college sports to allow this to happen. And that's what makes this recent news significant. With name, image, and likeness, like you said in the beginning, there is this possibility that athletes will at least be able to receive some compensation beyond the athletic scholarships. They'll be able to access some of the market for their fame and for their talent.
And we got here, we're all gathered around microphones this morning because of legislation in the state of California that would clear the way for that in a recent NCAA meeting, which opened the door to the possibility of athletes sharing in this multi-billion dollar industry. Is that correct, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm glad you said the possibility, because it was first reported as the NCAA and its member schools were going to do this. They were going to allow college athletes to finally capitalize on their name, images, and likenesses. But that's not actually what the NCAA said. The NCAA said, we're going to consider it, and we're going to consider it and possibly allow it under a series of conditions that we're now going to talk about and figure out. And if you look at their sort of press release and the bullet points that came along with it, these are all restrictive conditions. The NCAA is not thinking about having a perfectly free and open market like the one the rest of us in America already enjoy, the one that college coaches already enjoy. They're going to try to chisel away and make this as restrictive as possible so that they can keep, I think, most of the money and all of the power over these exchanges. The big question is, that's not what the California law that's going to go into effect in a few years says. That's not what the laws in other states are being proposed today. And even here in Washington, D.C., where I am, there are people in Congress proposing legislation about this. They also want to make it much more open. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there.
I want to bring in our athletes now and hear from both of you and get your top line reaction. Michael, I'll start with you. I saw you nodding furiously as we were talking about this. So so when you heard all of this, that all of a sudden athletes can perhaps share in this bounty, what did you think?
I thought about time. I mean, I was one of those athletes who played in the times where Ed O'Bannon, right after Ed O'Bannon, and those guys at UCLA, Earl Watson, Jerron Rush, and these guys were mega stars. And so what you had was an opportunity for those guys to be compensated for their likenesses, but they were denied that. And if you look at the NCAA, it's an archaic system that hasn't been, mandated or hasn't, been refreshed in so many years. And so even though with them saying the possibility to have student athletes compensated, they're still trying to hold on to that control that they know that they're losing. Because whenever the money, which are the players, begin to revolt, you have to make sure you can change with the times. And they've been so behind the times that now they're trying to catch up, where now as states are making their own rules. And for me, I absolutely love it. I think it's past time. And I think, for the student athletes now, it's so much more, so much broader because social media is out there. These guys are stars before they come to the NCAA. So the NCAA is not making these young men and women stars. They're already stars when they get there.
Right. Kerry, what did you think? I mean, some people would say it takes away the charm of amateur college sports. What do you think about that?
So I think there is progress in that athletes should be paid for their collegiate, for playing on the field and bringing revenues to these programs. But I think, my concern would be how you manage the divide that could potentially create. And, from not only within a team, how that might create the divide and affect personalities. And you get that in pro, and I understand that. But this is still, the NCAA has said they want it still, it must fall and be consistent with the collegiate model. So to me, when you add in $130,000 that a quarterback could be making, at a big-time school, does that further divide between sports and, among the sports, and then also a gender issue from, women's and men's sports?
I want to stay with that for a second and talk a little bit more about the gender divide, but also the divide between stars on a team and those who are not, and those in a revenue sport, basketball and football traditionally, and those on the lacrosse team or the fencing team, depending on, if you're in the Ivy League or not. How do you think fix that potential gap, or do we need to worry about it, do you think, Kerry?
Well, I think how we fix it is addressing or is, managing how the divisions kind of lay out their rule structure for what this compensation looks like. For me personally, I would love to see collegiate athletes paid as employees and, as they're contributing to the business or the program. And then that could at least create an equal standard. We know that NCAA is oozing with cash, so why not use that to pay athletes and then potentially pool out some additional money that might go to higher earning programs or teams or even players within that, but to at least create a baseline of some compensation, because I think there are going to be some, you know, quarterbacks out there and running backs and big time players that are, you know, salivating at the idea of making a bunch of money. And then there's most of the rest of the collegiate athletes are like, well, this doesn't mean anything to me.
So, Michael, would you be good if there was some sort of base compensation on top of scholarships for athletes, and then just let the marketplace rule, just like it would be in professional sports? Those who are superstars are going to make a ton of money, and then the rest of them are going to make whatever they make. Would you be okay with that?
I would be okay with that. I mean, because that's the way of the world. You know, you don't. The world is a competitive place. Every other marketplace, every other job structures are set up. If you are doing the job the best, you get compensated the most. It doesn't change. I think the mindset has to change around the fact that we still call college sports amateur sports. They're not amateur sports when you're making billions of dollars off of these athletes and off of TV rights and et cetera. So they're not amateur sports. You lose amateur sports when you get out of high school. The only entity that's been able to capitalize is the NCAA off of the amateur sports, quote unquote. So for me, the baseline compensation is fine, but giving these young people an opportunity to be compensated from what they put in, their work that they put in as athletes, we know if you're putting in a lot of work, it's going to show on the field of play. I think with the gender divide, too, I think you have to address that with the initial compensation packages if you go that way, because women's sports have naturally been not compensated even at the professional levels as the way as men's sports has. So you have to make sure you're dealing with that from the offset.
Patrick, come on back into the conversation here with us, yeah, and tell me what you, you've been listening to this. Tell me what you think about how we might structure an equitable compensation package.
Sure. Well, I think we're really talking about sort of two separate things here. When we're talking about direct compensation from school, so it's a salary on next to or on top of whatever scholarship you're getting or any aid you're getting for academics, that's different than sort of name, image, and likeness compensation, which in the context of what the NCAA is talking about and the California laws are talking about, these other laws are talking about, is third-party compensation. So nothing to do with athletes becoming employees of the schools. I think those are two separate conversations. I am completely in favor of athletes being able to become employees of the schools and get the best possible deal they can from these schools that want their talents. I think the schools should have to compete for that. I think they should be able to sign contracts. The whole term student athlete was invented by the NCAA. It's a legal fiction. It is used so that they don't have to pay workers' comp to injured athletes. So I'm super in favor of that. But in terms of NILs, that really has to do with, you know, a shoe company that wants to put their shoes on your feet, or a local car dealer wants to put you in an ad. And I think in terms of that, I actually think we might be selling short a lot of the non-star, quote-unquote star athletes across college sports. Yeah, somebody like Duke basketball star Zion Williamson probably would do extremely well in a world where he could tap into his name, image, and likeness rights while still playing at Duke. But I think that there are a lot of college athletes who would have a lot of different revenue opportunities in that same world, not just the biggest stars that are on TV. A lot of these athletes are very popular within the town or this college place that they're playing. They are celebrities in their hometowns where they come from. Their teams are popular locally and regionally. And this goes for female athletes as well as male athletes. We have quite a few female Olympians that have gone to do college sports and had to give up endorsement opportunities in order to do that. They could capitalize on that. And even on a much smaller scale than most of us think about, you know, there's opportunities to go home in the summer, put your name on a summer camp and be paid for that. There's opportunities for smaller perks. You know, for instance, you know, the local bar in your college town, come in, can you come sign autographs for an hour and we'll pay you X? Or, you know what, just every time you come to eat here, it's on us, right? Little things that we don't think about, but if you're an athlete, that's a lot better than nothing. And right now, all that stuff is an NCAA violation and it stinks. You should be able to cash in on that. It would be good. So, like I said, I don't think we have to worry as much about whether it's going to be fair or not, and the market will sort of sort that out. But I do think there are many athletes who would benefit at least a little more from this than they do from the current system, and I think that'd be great.
I want to come back after a break and talk about Zion Williamson and like every other possible college athlete. But we're going to take a little break. You guys will stick with me?
Yeah, we'll be
talk
here.
More about this on the other side. I'm Sam Zeff. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about college athletes being able to profit from their image. Back with us, our guest journalist, Patrick Ruby. He's in Washington. Patrick, thanks for sticking around.
Thanks for having me.
And former college basketball player Michael Watson from UMKC and former college soccer player Kerry Fry Robinson in the studio with me. Thanks for sticking around.
No problem.
All right. So, you know, we mentioned Zion Williamson, the Duke superstar, now in the NBA. And you can be pretty sure that Adidas or somebody else would have paid him a lot of money when he was at Duke to wear his shoes. But, Michael, UMKC is not a particularly big basketball power, not on a national platform. But there still would have been opportunities for a local guy like you to cash in a little money. Talk to me about that.
It would have been a great opportunity. I mean, I grew up literally less than a mile from UMKC. I can walk there from my childhood home. And that's one of the big reasons that I stayed in Kansas City was because of the network that I could build, you know, for the rest of my life. And so to be able in 2000, 2004, when the Chiefs weren't doing so hot, you know, when the Royals weren't doing so hot, to be able to be put into that limelight and that spotlight to receive, you know, car dealership promotions or be able to sign autographs, or they sold my jerseys, you know, 22s back in the day. But, you know, I didn't see any money from that. It would have been a tremendous help. And I love what he said out from D.C. about we don't see even the small wins that could happen from these guys who go back to their hometowns and they're megastars and they can receive Duke camps and in their towns, their college towns, where they're superstars and they could, you know, have their name and likenesses put on places as advertisements and promotions. That goes a long way. And I think to the point of how the divide could possibly happen on teams, where if you're an athlete, you know you have roles on your team. There are any good college coach is going to define the roles at the beginning of the season. You're my star. You're my scorer. You're my defensive player. You're my hustle player. So they're going to know their roles. Even in NBA, I mean, LeBron makes $30 million a year, but the base salary is $700,000 a year. They know their role. So I don't think it would cause as much of a divide if it was in college and these guys are making a little bit more money. The fact that anyone is making money is a win for everybody.
Kerry, I want to get your reaction. So I hear over and over that, you know what, the scholarship is worth, it could be, $100,000, $200,000. Clearly school is a lot more expensive than when I was at the University of Kansas. And so if you stay on scholarship for 4 years and, you know, you're going to get $200,000 worth of benefits. And so why aren't you happy about that?
Why am I happy about that?
No, why shouldn't a college athlete just be grateful for that support in their education?
I think a lot of college athletes are. So I went to Indiana from 01 to 05, and I was grateful for that financial assistance. I wasn't looking for more money. I wasn't, you know, hoping that my jerseys would be sold so that I could make more income, because that wasn't the economy in women's sports then. Yeah. You know, but fast forward to today, I think that I think there's been a cultural shift and a mentality shift too with the generation of expecting more from what they're bringing to the table. I think social media has accelerated awareness of collegiate athletes across the board. So I think you can and should be excited about that financial assistance, because I know a lot of athletes in my days growing up here that weren't able to go to college without sports. They couldn't attend top universities. They couldn't get the tutoring they needed to get themselves into med school without the assistance of like the soccer program. So I know there's a lot of soft benefits that come with being an athlete, but I can also see the flip side of, you know, you should have been, you know, cashing in on people buying 22. So
man.
Well, Well, you know, anymore, and I'm thinking about the KU soccer program that is doing really well. People are buying tickets to come in and watch them play. And I think, you know, sure, the scholarship is nice and you're going to, you know, you're going to a frontline university, but, you know, they're not coming to see the coach. They're not coming there to see the athletic director. They're coming there to see the players. They should share in that bounty. Do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the talent is the one that's they're bringing the fans. It might be part of the program or the legacy and or proximity to Kansas City. You know, KU women were just playing down at Swope Park, and I took my daughter and a friend, and we bundled up on Friday night and watched some women's soccer. So, you know, and we were there watching the players, not seeing how the coaches matched up or anything like that. So. Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to do it. I just don't know what that looks like, and I don't think the NCAA knows what that looks like either, because they've kind of handed it off and said, "You guys figure it out."
Right,
Patrick, do you think the NCAA has any clue about what this should look like?
I mean, I think they would like it to look as much as possible the same way it looks now. Like, I think they're really happy the status quo, and I don't say that out of matter of opinion. I mean, I said as someone who has watched the NCAA spend tens of millions of dollars defending the status quo in federal antitrust court. You know, they've made it very clear what they want, and the only reason they're talking about changing this, again, they're not actually changing it yet, they're talking about it, is because the California state legislature, other state legislatures, and potentially Congress are all holding the equivalent of a legislative gun to their head to force them to change. And if you look at the history of the NCAA and its changes over the course of decades about amateurism rules, they always and only change in response to legislative pressure, legal pressure, and public shaming pressure. So they've never, out of the goodness of their hearts, decided, you know what, we want to share more power and more money with the athletes. It's always been because they've been forced to.
Right.
And again, in their defense, that's pretty standard across the board from powerful institutions. They generally don't like to share unless forced.
Well, power doesn't like to give up power.
That's exactly right. It's how you get powerful in the first place. but my other feeling with all of this is that, again, there is this difference between, and I think the NCAA is afraid of this, and the schools are afraid of this. I think they're afraid that if they give on the name, image, and likeness thing, if they allow a full or some kind of free market for athletes when it comes to their own property, by the way, your name, image, and likeness is yours. It's amazing that we are talking about this as if the NCAA is doing something generous and doing a favor to these athletes when actually they've been stealing this property from the athletes for decades. It should even be the discussion of theirs to decide what to do with it. It should be up to the athletes, but that's a separate philosophical discussion. I think they're afraid that if they give on this, the next thing that happens is maybe the next antitrust lawsuit is successful. And when that happens, then the door to what we talked about earlier, athletes as employees, is open. And then you're talking about salaries and workers' comp and health insurance and all these expensive things that they would prefer not to do. And I think that might be what you're seeing here, is the NCAA trying to figure out, how can we thread a needle to do just enough to get our critics and lawmakers off our backs, but not have to have a totally free market system where we lose control.
Yeah. Michael, I want to, I think we should clarify here that, you know, we talk a lot about, well, you're going to get a four-year education, but just because you have a scholarship, that doesn't guarantee 4 years. The university, the school can pull that scholarship whenever they feel like it.
Yeah, that's the selling point. They'll get you, oh, man, you can have a four-year ride. No, you have a one-year off, you know, when you're out, when you're playing college sports, period. And so you're not guaranteed one year contract. You're not guaranteed 4 years. I mean, if a coach comes in, you have a coaching change, the culture will change. We don't need you here any longer. So you're basically, you know, an at will employee, you know, already in college, you know, but you're just not getting compensated, you know, for that. So it's a lot of just, you know, like you said, philosophical things that this is my likeness. This is my image. You took it from me, and now you're trying to sell it back and piece. You're trying to piece it back to me as if it's not, if it hadn't already belonged to me. You know, and so I think what he did say is, this is going to force the NCAA to open up, either open up, change with the times, or cease to exist. That's really where this is, and is where it's headed, in my opinion.
Carrie, do you feel that way? Do you think that, does this feel like finally a sea change in the way college athletes are treated by the university and by the NCAA?
That's a good question. I think there will be change because there has to be. And, you know, it depending on how it's implemented and what the rules are, that's going to determine what the future of or the next 5-10 years of collegiate sports looks like. I think one of the fundamental questions I have is, so a lot of this is brought as a result of the NCAA making millions of dollars off of collegiate athletes. Yet the NCAA is not saying, okay, well, we'll use part of the revenue we're bringing in to pay you and, you know, right. to give you that salary. Instead, they're saying, we'll let other people pay you, exactly. but we're still going to keep exactly. all that money. You know, thank Come you very on. Much. So to me, that's curious. You know, I don't feel like there's alignment there in holding NCAA accountable for sharing, you know, revenue share on image, name, and likeness.
And that's exactly why they worded their this that way, so that they wouldn't be liable or on the hook to be able to actually compensate out of their own revenue. And they make billions of dollars, not millions, billions of dollars off of the NCAA. It's a governing body that really no one asked to govern to begin with. They came in, they saw, you know, that there was, we can put these colleges together, and then they just capitalized, kind of like, you know, a huge company like a Walmart or a, you know, they're that kind of entity, and they've been untaxed and, you know, and really not legislated for whatever reason until here lately. And like he said, they don't move unless they're forced to move. They don't move because, oh man, look at these athletes. They will sell you on the fact that we're giving these college athletes scholarships and they're going to, and that's a great thing. But when the college coach can make $7 million a year, you know, when the even a mid-major school, he's making $500,000. These kids are going to come out with a scholarship and 90% of them are going to be $40,000 to $70,000, if that, coming out of school. Yeah, they're not going to have any debt, but they're not coming out after all the work they put in for 4 to 5 years being compensated as such. It just doesn't make sense.
You know, three basketball coaches in my beloved Kansas are millionaires.
Oh, of course.
Right. KU, K-State, and Wichita State, which, you know, moved up into the top ranks.
Yeah, they're high major now.
Right. And so that's a ton of money. And even though the scholarships are good, you do read stories that, you know, there's not, you still have to, if you have a car, you still have to get gas, you can eat at the training table, but, you know, that's sometimes not enough. It's really more of a full-time job than people think.
Absolutely.
It's two full-time
yeah,
jobs.
Yeah, it is. And then you have to, you know, and then managing all the expectations that that the athletics program is putting on you for the field, mm-hmm. and then the expectations that you must have academically, and then not to mention attempting to have a social life.
There is no social life. Your day starts at 6 a.m. and it ends at 9 p.m., 10 p.m. every night. So you are overworked. If this was a 40-hour work week, you know, to say, you're overworked. And so the NCAA knows exactly what they're doing. They've been knowing it. And the pushback on it, it's only gonna grow, you know. And so for the new legislation and then what they're trying to do and saying other people can pay you, they're still passing the buck. They're still not taking accountability and responsibility for their student athletes.
Patrick, do you think that we're on the cusp of a sea change here?
I think we're on the cusp of a change. Whether it qualifies as a sea change remains to be seen. Like I mentioned earlier. It's not totally up to the NCAA and its schools anymore, right. No matter how they sound in their press releases and in their sort of public communications. This is really going to be decided in legislatures, and not just state legislatures. I think it's going to be decided here in Washington and Congress, because everyone's going to want some sort of national solution, I guess is the word you could use for this. And what I think what will happen is, look, the NCAA and its schools, right? They've got a lot of lobbyists. They've got a lot of clout with lawmakers in general. They've had that for a long time on all sorts of issues. This is one more issue where they can come in they're going to be able to get their message across to those lawmakers. The question, and this is an unanswered question, is how receptive are lawmakers going to be? Things have changed a lot in the last 15, 20 years on this issue, right? They've changed in public opinion. If you look at the polling now, the majority of people are in favor of athletes having name, image, and likeness rights. That used to not be the case. A growing number of people are in favor of them even being paid like employees. That used to not be the case. The NCAA itself is hated. Nobody likes them. Like, right. They're not popular. And one reason you see politicians moving on the NCAA is because it makes political hay to do so. Politicians aren't stupid, right? They don't attack popular things. They attack things that are unpopular. So if the NCAA and schools come to here in D.C. and they come to people in Congress and they come to the state legislature, they say, hey, cut us a deal, cut us a break, do what we say, do it the way we want it. That doesn't mean the lawmakers have to listen. And in fact, I'm not sure what kind of leverage and what the NCAA and its schools can even offer those lawmakers at this point. It may be out of their hands. And I'm very curious to see if that's what happens.
So this started in California, Patrick. Where is it spread? What other state houses are dealing with this right now?
You see a lot. You've seen talk in Colorado. You've seen talk in Florida. I believe there's talk in Michigan about it. I think there's about a dozen states where bills have been proposed, or people are talking about how they're going to propose bills very shortly. And some of them are talking about an accelerated timeline. So not waiting until 2023 like the California law, but as soon as next year. And also, again, here in D.C., in Representative Mark Walker from North Carolina already has a bill in the House that would essentially allow for this. And there are people in the Senate, including Mitt Romney, who are talking about putting together a Senate bill on this. I've talked to some people on background about this, and they've all told me, don't be surprised if you see more on this relatively soon. So I'm not sure lawmakers are going to wait for the NCAA and its whatever 50th subcommittee on this to get done talking and come up with more talking points and talk about another time where we'll talk about it again and then maybe have a plan. They might, I think the clock might be accelerated here. And like I said, I'd just be interested to see how far do lawmakers want to take this? Because the ball is really in their court, so to speak.
Are you okay, Patrick, as we're wrapping up our conversation here? Clearly, this is going to be more money for sports agents, lawyers, people like that. Are you okay with them dipping in, making a little extra dough on college athletes?
I mean, I'm fine with that. I mean, it's also going to be more money for the Internal Revenue students. If college athletes are getting income, they're going to be taxed on it. That's actually good for us as taxpayers in the society. So the key point to me is if all those people around you as an athlete that have to help you negotiate your deal, manage your money, pay your taxes, whatever, right? If they're getting a cut, that's fine because that means you as the athlete are still taking home more money. And that's great. That's like anybody that gets a job or a financial opportunity. I think that's wonderful. So yeah, I'm totally okay with that. I mean, one of the funniest things I always hear is like, oh my God, if these athletes were able to make money, they'd have to pay taxes. Well, it's like, duh, so what? You still have more money in your pocket at the end of the day. That's a good thing.
I just want to be clear that I'm paying taxes, and I never complain about making making more money and paying more taxes. I want to wrap this up with the message that our athletes here want to leave with a people that they want to leave with their elected representatives. And Carrie, I'll start with you.
Well, I think this is an opportunity to formulate a change that will benefit athletes, and my hope that is it can be done at a level that kind of maintains the charm, as you noted, of collegiate sports, because, you know, it's kind of like a childhood. You should enjoy it. Enjoy where it is until it accelerates to the point of you're an adult and now you have responsibilities. I see for a female athlete, I see colleges that that opportunity where you can still be part of something really great and you can be compensated for it, hopefully, before, you know, professionalism really takes a grab and changes things.
Michael, your message.
Yeah, I think it's like the marijuana system. You either, you know, get with it and so you can get paid off of it, get taxed off of it. The NCAA has always had agents and people in the business, and that's a known fact for people around the business. So now you can kind of legislate a little bit better. I think for my message is It's about time. I think we need to understand how it would benefit the student athlete more and worry about that more than how it would benefit the NCAA. And I do think that it will be, you know, handled in the Senate, in the, you know, in the legislature, more so than it would be in the NCAA.
Michael Watson, former UMKC basketball star, man who has did my favorite mashup of the day, weed and college athletes.
Come on now.
thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Kerry Fry Robinson, former soccer player at the University of Indiana. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Patrick Ruby in Washington, D.C. Thank you for your reporting and your expertise.
Thank you. Really enjoyed this conversation.
I'm Sam Zeff. When Central Standard returns, bet you can't eat just one. A new KU study is taking the first step in understanding what constitutes a hyper-palatable food, essentially food that you just can't stop eating. That's next. Stay with me. College basketball, weed, video games. I am thoroughly enjoying today's show. Right now, we're going to switch gears into a mystery that we can all relate to. Have you ever been eating a bag of potato chips and wondered, why can't I stop? Turns out there is a scientific reason for this scenario, and a researcher at the University of Kansas is taking the first step in understanding it. Dr. Tara Fazzino is with us now, joining us from KPR in Lawrence to explain what a hyper-palatable food is. Tara, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Couldn't be happier to have you here. All right, let's start at the beginning. Define for me hyper-palatable food.
Sure. So hyper-palatable foods are designed with multiple key ingredients that are linked to enhanced palatability. So that would be sugar, salt, fat, and or carbohydrates. And when foods have a combination of these ingredients, so two or more, in a single food, what can happen is there's a synergy that is created by these foods where you experience sort of an artificially enhanced experience of palatability, and it can essentially make them difficult to stop eating for some people.
It's not just the presence of those, it's a precise combination of that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So really we see, and from our research, we found that really just moderate to high levels of these key ingredients may be implicated in sort of this artificially enhanced experience of palatability. And I will point out that to distinguish, you know, these ingredients, when they occur alone in foods sort of naturally, you know, they would not sort of have the same level of a rewarding experience that you would have if they are combined in a single food.
Right. So there are scientists sitting around in white coats and laboratories and different food companies figuring out, how is it that I get somebody to keep sticking their hand in the bag?
Yeah, so I think there's a variety of food companies that have done a lot of work and a lot of research in this area to, you know, make foods that are very appealing to consume. And so part of the conundrum with the scientific area of the literature is that we really previously haven't had a specific definition of what these are, what they, you know, what the levels of the ingredients or even the ingredients that would be comprised in a food to make it that appealing. And so that's some of the reason why I took on this research.
Yeah. So let's just stop right there and talk to me about the research and what you've discovered heretofore.
Sure. So previously the field has used essentially descriptive definitions of palatable foods, for example, fast foods, sweets, desserts, but really, those foods, we can't sort of quantify with those descriptive definitions, obviously. They make comparisons across studies difficult, and they're not actually specific to the mechanisms, which would be the ingredients that would be implicated in the enhanced palatability. So what we did was we conducted a study using a data-driven approach to develop a quantitative definition of hyper-palatable foods. We found that using some data, we found that the foods largely fell into three clusters. One being a fat and sodium cluster that had moderate to high levels of fat and sodium, another cluster that had moderate to high levels of fat and simple sugars, and then a third cluster that had carbohydrates and sodium.
And so now that we know that, what do we do with it?
So there are several things that we can do with it, really. What we did initially with this definition was we, as sort of a part two of our research, we applied it to a data set that's available from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that's essentially considered representative of the U.S. food system. So first we wanted to quantify, okay, well, now that we have a definition, you know, what does this actually look like in our food system? How prevalent are these foods? And so we found essentially after looking at prevalence in several different ways, ultimately we found over 60% of foods available in the U.S. food system did meet our criteria for hyperpalatability. So really suggesting that a substantial, you know, proportion of the foods available to us may be, you know, sort of you know, have enhanced characteristics of palatability. So from here, what we can do is, you know, first of all, there's as scientists, we need to conduct more research. And ultimately, if we're able to establish a very strong scientific body of evidence behind the definition that we're proposing, we could ultimately use that to help inform public policy regulation. Because, you know, so far, you know, part of the difficulty with public policy level regulation has been that we don't really have a specific definition to inform legislatures like, you know, this is what the problem is. And we can't really regulate or, you know, ban entire classes of foods like fast foods or desserts. So really, you know, if we're able to develop a body of evidence surrounding this definition, then we could use it to, for example, inform, you know, maybe food companies could label foods that are hyperpalatable so that consumers are aware of what they're consuming, but it would also preserve consumer choice. Another method would be to have legislation surrounding the specific levels of the ingredients that would be on the market, so to sort of limit the effects of, you know, the hyperpalatability.
So you said that 60% of the research suggests 60% of food falls into this category. That really seems like a big number to me. Were you surprised by that?
Oh, absolutely. I really was. I also thought it looked pretty high, which is why we looked at prevalence in multiple ways, because we thought, well, you know, maybe with one method it might suggest something higher, but another method might, you know, provide, you know, more of a conservative estimate. And it really wasn't the case. It was really, you know, sort of over 60% in any way that we looked at it. The foods were hyperpalatable. But I think that's part of the utility in having a definition like this is because, you know, the foods that we might not necessarily consider as, you know, hyperpalatable with a descriptive definition, you know, many of those were captured in our quantitative definition. So I think that was helpful to sort of broaden the conceptualization of, like, what are we talking about here when we're talking about hyperpalatable foods?
Is there an opposite to hyperpalatable food?
I don't know if it's an opposite, but I would just say that palatable foods generally are, you know, they exist and they need to exist because, you know, we need to eat to survive, right? So, I mean, you know, any type of food that occurs naturally, for example, a fresh apple, you know, a piece of, let's say, pork chop. I mean, those things are naturally palatable, and they should be because we need to have, you know, as humans, we need to have, you know, some motivation to eat to sustain ourselves and to survive. You know, so those foods are out there and they need to be. And so I think that's sort of the, I don't know if you call it an opposite, but sort of the foods that I would not hypothesize to be hyperpalatable, which would be, you know, the foods that are naturally occurring, you know, that have, you know, sort of limited sort of, you know, added ingredients or, you know, ways in which they've been prepared that really sort of preserve their sort of original structure.
A long list of ingredients should be a clue that maybe this is something you should leave on the shelf.
It could be. We in our research, we did not look at level of processing or number of ingredients or anything like that. We strictly just looked at, you know, the ingredients linked directly to palatability. So I think that would be an area for future research. But generally, I think, you know, if there's a lot going on in the food, you might want to check it out.
Is it true that you might think that you've picked up a healthy snack at the grocery store, but the trail mix that you've picked up could in fact fall into this hyper palatability category?
Sure. Yes. Trail mix is a nice example, particularly if you pick up, you know, trail mix, salted nuts, maybe there's a little bit of chocolate in there, you know, with, you know, the fat plus the sodium, that could be an easy way to meet hyperpalatability. I mean, to that regard too, we also, in our research, we looked at foods in the database that were labeled as reduced, low, or no in some of those key ingredient levels. So salt, sugar, fat, and or calories. And we actually found that among all of them, 49% met our criteria for hyperpalatability. So potentially, you know, some of these foods that could be marketed for, like, let's say, weight management, you know, appear to have similar levels of ingredients as some of the other foods that we sort of, you know, more typically consider to be foods that are difficult to stop eating, or, you know, sort of foods that you want to sort of tread lightly around. And so we found that, you know, even this really extended into foods that that people might be trying to use for weight control.
Yeah. So a handful of trail mix may be fine, but if it's been hyper palatable, then you might have, you know, that the eighth handful of trail mix may be sending you down the wrong road.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you, you know, are sort of considering, you know, if individuals are considering for themselves, like, you know, well, what do we do with this now that you've developed this definition, but we haven't directly translated it for the public because we need more research? I mean, I think, you know, a couple ways to go about that, like, you know, if there's multiple ingredients that you can identify on the package that might be high in those types of, in the ingredients linked to palatability, that might be a clue. And conversely, if you're looking for something that, you know, you're hoping will not be, for example, if you find nuts that are unsalted, they would just have, you know, sort of the main ingredient would be fat. And that, according to our research, did not fall into the definition of hyperpalatability.
Right. So what the research suggests right now is that consumers need to be aware. We're not talking about not making it available, not letting them have it, but making sure that they understand that what they're picking up may be the kind of food that you just can't put down.
I think that's a good first step in terms of, you know, getting, you know, sort of our work out to the broader public is that, exactly. These, you know, these foods, and there may be a lot of them that might be sort of, you know, difficult to stop consuming for some people. I think, you know, we can, moving forward, you know, as I mentioned, ultimately, you know, I would like to translate this definition for the public and for public use. We just, at this point, need more research to sort of confirm our initial indications that this is going to be a useful tool.
Dr. Tara Fazzino joining us from KPR, University of Kansas researcher, here to talk to us about Big Chip and Big Nut. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thanks so much.
KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Browell, Mackenzie Martin, Noah Tabora, Sylvia Maria Gross, the Central Standard senior producer. We're going to step aside tomorrow for live NPR coverage of the impeachment hearing, so you're going to want to join us for that. Central Standard will be back on Monday. For now, I'm Sam Zeff. Stay right where you are for Up to Date with Steve Kraske.